Continue. This is lecture 18. The problem that we are currently addressing is to somehow, we want to quantify how much quantum fields fluctuate. In which way do they fluctuate and how much? And in particular, not sick, is it? There'll be a mob. Okay, so in particular, we want to know how large are the typical fluctuations as a function of their spatial size. We're already suspecting that fluctuations of large spatial size are going to be typically of small amplitude, and that those of small spatial size might be more likely to have a large amplitude. To this end, to quantify that, we already pursued one approach. Namely, we considered the observable phi index b, which is the field operator smeared over the field operators smeared over a region B. So we are measuring the average amplitude of a field over a patch rather than at a point. The size of the patch we assume to be L. So here we have the field operator at the field at particular points in space, and we smear that over that patch by integrating over the entire region multiplied with a window function. I could write here R3 or B, it's the same thing because the window enforces that integration region. Then we calculated on that basis what the mean value is of the amplitude found in this region. So we calculated the expectation value of that operator phi b, assuming that the field is in the state omega, which in turn we assume to be the state zero for some choice of mode function, presumably the vacuum. But we are free to choose as we please here. In practice, it'll be the vacuum state. And then we found that the phi b operator is a linear combination, it's an integral over linear combinations of A and A dagger operators. But the expectation value of the A operator is zero, and the expected vacuum expectation value of the A dagger operator is also zero. So overall, there's no contribution. The field operator phi b fluctuates around the value zero. Now, what's the variance? This is really the number that we are after. The variance is the square of the standard deviation. It's the expectation value of the mean deviation from the mean. The mean itself is zero. Therefore, the calculation of the variance reduces to the calculation of the expectation value of phi squared, phi b squared. Now, unlike phi b, which is simply a linear combination of a term with that's proportional to a, and another one is proportional to a dagger, as here, the square of phi b has a squared terms, a dagger a terms, and a dagger squared terms. The a squared terms don't contribute because the a annihilates that vector here. The a dagger annihilates that vector. this way, annihilates that vector over there. But we are left with one term here, something or other multiplied with a dagger. We did a number of calculations and approximations, and we arrived at this end result. Namely that if we measure the field amplitude averaged over a patch of size L, of diameter L, then the variance of the outcome of that measurement, therefore the typical size of the quantum fluctuation, is scale factor to the power of minus 2 multiplied with the co-moving momentum to the third power. And here we have the mode function modulo squared, where the number k here, the co-moving momentum k, was actually 2 pi over L. So in practice, this tells us the answer to that question that we had earlier. How does the size of the fluctuations depend on the length scale of the fluctuations? If we choose a particular length scale, L, then we can plug that in, then k is 2 pi over L. So we choose a particular box size, then we get a number k, we plug that in here, we get an explicit value from evaluating the mode function. Explicit value here, we look at the time that we're interested in, that gives us an explicit number there, that's the variance. So whatever box size we choose, whatever time we look at it, this formula gives us the standard deviation in the outcome of the measurement of the field averaged over the box. Now there is another way of looking at this. I mean, we will eventually plug in the actual mode function, of course, and then we will see exactly how that scaling behavior goes. So far we have little intuition into what the behavior of the mode function is and therefore what the behavior of the quantum fluctuations is going to be, but that's what we will study today. Just to remind you of one little thing, we have here the mode function squared divided by the scale factor squared. Remember that this is really the mode function of the chi field, which is not the physical field. But the mode function divided by the scale factor is the mode function of the phi field, the physical field. So really what we have here is k to the third power times the modulus of the mode function of the physical phi field. Now, there is another way to characterize how the amplitude of quantum fluctuations depends on the length scale of those quantum fluctuations. And even though the approach is very different, it will turn out that the result will be a formula just like that. So we will see that we obtain that expression in two ways, and in each case it is expressing the behavior of quantum fluctuations. Here it is the variance in the outcome of the measurement of the averaged field in a box, and here's another way to do it. Namely, think of it like this. A quantum field is going to fluctuate everywhere all the time. Now pick out two points in space and measure the amplitude here, measure the amplitude over there. Here it might come out positive, there it might come out negative. Now repeat that in an ensemble. Each time you perform the measurements, you get two numbers. You get the outcome of the measurement of the field here and the outcome of the measurement of the field over there. It may be that the fluctuations at the first point are correlated with the fluctuations at the second point. You find out if you do this ensemble measurement. For example, it may turn out that whenever the first measurement comes out with a positive value, the measurement at the second point may tend to also come out with a positive value. If at the first place you measure a negative amplitude, chances are perhaps that you measure a negative amplitude over there as well. That would be a sign of a correlation between the two fluctuations. They wouldn't be completely independent. Now, how can we measure correlations? Correlations between fluctuations. And in particular, how can we measure how the amount of correlation depends on the distance between the two points? You would certainly expect that if we take two points in space that are very far apart from each other, that the fluctuations are pretty much independent. if they're very close, there might be a strong correlation between them. Now, the way to calculate correlations is usually you measure your two measurements, multiply them together, and obtain a number. And then you perform this again in an ensemble measurement, right? So you do another one of those ensemble measurements. You measure again here, measure there, take the two measurement values, multiply them together. And then, after you've done that many times, you take those products and calculate their average. That will be the correlator. Why? Well, imagine the two measurements are actually correlated. So one comes out positive when the other comes out positive. One comes out negative when the other one comes out negative. That would mean correlated. It means that all those products are positive, right? Because positive is multiplied with positive, negative tends to be multiplied with negative. So all those products are positive, the average value will be positive as well. So the larger the expectation value of the product is, the stronger is the correlation. If you find something that's negative, then it means there's anti-correlation. Positive amplitude here tends to imply negative amplitude over there. Let's see what we get for quantum fluctuation. Correlations, no correlation, or anti-correlation. Now, before we do that, let me remind you that correlations are very important also classically in information theory and in its applications in signal processing. So let's look at classical noise fluctuations, just to see what's going on classically. Let's assume that n of t is some noise signal. So it's an electrical signal in a wire, let's say. And it's just noise. That's why I call it n. N of t is some noise signal. Let's assume that it is white noise. And by white, I mean all frequencies occur equally. And that it is band limited, which means it's white up to a certain maximum frequency, and then there's no frequency above that. So it's basically something like that, but you've passed it through a low-pass filter so that only frequencies up to a particular maximum frequency are left over. So in this case, let's assume that the frequencies are between minus omega and plus omega. In practice, take your signal, Fourier transform it, then cut away everything that's outside that interval, and then Fourier transform back. Then you obtain a band-limited signal. So we have band-limited white noise. One can show that, similar to the quantum case, when you have such a band-limited white noise signal, the expectation value of the amplitude is actually zero. No matter at what time you check, if you measure the amplitude at a particular time, and then you take another white noise signal with the same band limit and measure the amplitude at that time, and then another band-limited white noise signal and measure the amplitude at that time, keep going, calculate the average, it's going to be zero. Clearly, because there's no preference for positive or negative amplitudes built into this. So it's got to be zero. But what are the fluctuations? What are the properties of those fluctuations in this noise? Now let's look at the correlator. In principle, if we hadn't put a bandwidth cutoff in this, if this were white noise with all frequencies in it, then it would be a completely random signal. Whatever the amplitude now is would have no predictive power over what the amplitude a little later might be. But our noise signal is band limited. It doesn't have arbitrarily high frequencies in it. So therefore, it shouldn't really vary all too quickly. And in general, if, for example, the amplitude happens to be fairly large positive at one point in time, let's say the value is like, I don't know, 7 at a particular time, then a little moment later, it shouldn't be minus 100, right? Because it would be a very steep drop in the amplitude, which would require high frequency components in the Fourier transform. But we don't have frequencies beyond capital omega. So therefore, we expect that if you know the amplitude of a band-limited noise signal at one point in time, then you have the ability to guess somehow what the amplitude is going to be a tiny amount of time later. It's not going to be very different. Let us quantify that. Let us calculate what the average is of the amplitude of such a signal at one point in time, and then the amplitude at the point in time t shifted a little bit by L. So you take, you're holding t fixed, you're holding L fixed, and you take one of those signals, and you measure the amplitude at time t, measure the amplitude at time t plus L, multiply the two, and then you grabbed another signal from that class, do the same thing, and average the outcome. And this way you get the correlator between what the signal does at one time and what it does at another time. Since it's the correlation between the signal and itself, just at another time, this is actually called the autocorrelator. It's a self-correlator. So this is the autocorrelator, and we expect it to be non-zero, especially for time shifts that are not too big. It turns out this is the answer. And we will later calculate how that comes about. So the answer is that these amplitudes are going to be correlated. And in particular, if the time shift L is very small, then you see this is like sine x over x. It's just sine omega L over omega L. If the time shift is very small, this is basically 1. There's going to be a very strong correlation. Sure, right? I mean, if you just take like a trillionth of a second after your previous measurement, well, the amplitude is not going to have moved much. So you're pretty much measuring the same thing, very, very strong correlation. On the other hand, if you wait a little while and you see how the correlation goes down, even goes through 0, because the sine x over x, or sine omega L over omega L in this case, actually goes through 0. It's a sinc function, right? It looks like this. Goes down like this from 1, and then it oscillates. So what we see is that there is a point where the shift is such so large that they're completely uncorrelated, but then a little later they're correlated again, anti-correlated in fact. And then after a while there's a 0 again, and then they're correlated again, and so on, but just very little. Most of the correlation is really very close by. And all of this correlation comes about just because it's band limited, because the noise signal has to be built from plane waves that have all frequencies up to this maximum frequency and nothing above that. Okay, so that's an important relationship here, and we will look for the quantum analog of that, where we have the field at one position and the field at another position. And L will be the distance between the two positions. We'll ask, okay, the field fluctuates here, fluctuates there. Let's calculate what the correlator is in between them. And then we expect that for quantum fluctuations too, maybe not this formula will come out, but something similar, where the correlator is pretty large when they are close, those two points, and then it will decay as they get further apart from each other. So how can we see this result? Well, first we start by noticing that this noise is ergodic. And what that means is that when we calculate the correlator, we can make use of the following fact. Instead of using an ensemble of many noise signals and calculating that product for each noise signal, and then calculating the average, instead of that, we can take one noise signal and calculate that for different times, for one time, for later time, for later time, for later time. That's because, and that is what ergodicity means, it doesn't matter whether you hold the time fixed and you run through an ensemble of noise signals, or you take one noise signal and follow it in time. The statistics is going to be the same. So let's do this. We want to calculate the autocorrelation function here. And for that purpose, we simply take one noise signal, let's call it F, and then we calculate the product of F with f of t plus l. And we run through all t. We integrate that over all t, that's averaging. Now in practice, this might come out to be infinite because the noise is just keeping going, right? It just keeps going and the f doesn't have to be integrable or square integrable. But in that case, we just calculate a suitable regularized limit of it. So we would integrate from some minus capital T to some plus capital T, divide by the size of the interval, and then we get the average in this way. That's what is written here. Okay, so this is what we want to calculate for one fixed noise signal. And let us rewrite this by expressing the noise signal in terms of its Fourier transform. So we write f of t as the Fourier transform of f tilde of omega. If we do that, we express f of t in terms of f tilde of omega, a Fourier factor, and an integral over omega. F of t plus l is expressed in terms of f tilde of omega prime. The Fourier factor, now the time t, the time now is t plus capital L, and an integral over omega prime. Now, these two exponentials easily combine, of course, such that in particular we get e to the power of I t times omega plus omega prime. That's this factor here. Instead of writing these factors, we combine them different. We combine the arguments differently, and we write this product as this times that. Okay. Now we see that this invites integration over t, because all of the rest of the integrand doesn't depend on t. Here we have a t dependence. How nice! We can integrate that, and of course the integral over just a phase like that gives us a delta function in this argument up to a factor of 1 over 2 pi. So the integral over dt and this stuff gives us a Dirac delta of omega plus omega prime. And we can use that to get rid of the omega prime integration. So if we do this, then we obtain that the correlator is given by this integral here. It's just one integral over the frequency now. See, here we have f of omega times f tilde of omega times f tilde of minus omega. But remember that our f's are like electrical signals, so their amplitude is real, which means that their Fourier transform has the property that f tilde of minus omega is equal to f of omega complex conjugated. Right? Remember that? So what we really have here is f tilde of omega complex conjugated, and therefore this is the modulus squared of f of omega. So I can write this here. What we find is that the autocorrelation function, the size of the correlator as a function of the shift, is given by the Fourier transform of this thing here, which is the modulus of the Fourier transform squared. This, the modulus squared of the Fourier transform of the signal, is called the power spectrum. Power because it's squared. For electrical engineers, the square of the signal is the power. So the overall message is what is written here, namely that the autocorrelator, just a sec, the autocorrelator and the power spectrum are a Fourier pair. Yes?
Sorry, the delta is omega plus omega prime, right?
Delta of omega plus omega prime.
So between that line and the next line, what about the exponential?
Which one?
You wrote e to the I omega prime l in the first line and e I omega l in the second line.
Oh, you mean from here to
Yeah.
here? You're right. If that's a plus, that's got to be a minus.
I suppose it's going to turn out to be real anyway, so, well, the autocorrelator has to be real.
That's real. This is real, correct.
So it
Yes.
wouldn't matter.
So at the end, it cannot matter. That's correct. Did you have the same question? Okay, great. So I probably did make a mistake, but it made no difference at the end. Okay, yes.
This is for a Gaussian signal. So how much wiggle room do we have if we go away from a Gaussian signal? We still have the correlation functions, something similar to this?
Yeah, I'm getting to this. So the point now is that we had white band-limited noise. And so we arranged the signal to have this Fourier transform. We arranged the signal by assumption as white noise to have that this function here looks like this box over there. Okay? And now we can derive what I claimed earlier, namely that the autocorrelator is this sine of omega L over omega L, because the autocorrelator is the Fourier transform of the power spectrum. The power spectrum, by assumption of whiteness of the noise, is this box function. So it's zero everywhere, then it jumps up to here, constant frequency, and jumps down again. The Fourier transform of that is the sinc function, sine omega L over omega L. But I leave it to you as an exercise to work out that Fourier transform yourself. So keep that in mind, that there is this relationship between the spectral power, the power spectrum, and the autocorrelator. Now, in quantum field theory and curved space, we're interested in something very similar. We have the field at one point in space, the field at another point in space, separated from the first point by a separation L. And we measure the two field values at the same time, eta. We calculate the expectation value of that. So we are calculating the correlator, or autocorrelator, if you want to call it that. Now, how do we do that? Well, the field phi can be expressed in terms of the field chi. Just take chi over A, that's phi. Then I leave it to you as an exercise to use the mode expansion of chi that we developed earlier and a transformation to spherical coordinates to derive that when you plug the mode expansion into this, the two-point correlator comes out as this integral here. So this is the modulus of the co-moving momentum, because we are using spherical coordinates already. It's just an integral over the radius in co-moving momentum space. Here we have the sine of kl over L, similar to what we had above, and then we have this mode function here. And again, the mode function occurs together with the scale factor, so it's really the physical fields phi mode function that arises in here. Now let us simplify this a little further. It's going to be a crude approximation, but this is what will get us to a conclusion relatively quickly. We have here a sinc function arising, and the sinc function is approximately up to a matter of terms of order. I mean, in lower approximations, basically of order one, as long as this argument is small, as long as KL is smaller than 1 or K is smaller than 1 over L. On the other hand, the sinc function looks like this, and once this is large compared to 1, then we are in this further out region where we just have a little bit of ringing. And in a relatively good approximation, we can say that this is 0. It's just negligible compared to that first term. And therefore, we will truncate that integral here to just a finite range, because the sinc function becomes really small after a while. Also, what we really have in the integrand here is k squared times the sinc function. And that expression has its largest amplitude around the value k about 2 pi over L. So the bulk of the contribution to that integral comes from that particular value. Then admittedly, it's a crude estimate. But that estimate gives us that the two-point correlator is approximately 1 over a squared, just carried forward, the integral running from 0 to 2 pi over L because of that. And then we have here the integrand. So I replaced the sinc function here by that. And then finally, we've removed the integral as well using this observation, namely that the bulk of the integral comes from one particular value of k. We plug that in here, and we obtain that the two-point function roughly goes like this, 1 over a squared, mode function squared, which for chi, mode function for chi squared, which really means mode function for the field phi squared, times c k to the third power, evaluated at k equal to 2 pi over L. Now notice that this formula, or the right-hand side of this formula, is actually the same as what we had earlier at the end of last lecture. Here. We calculated the size of the standard deviation, we calculated the variance in the measurement of the amplitude, the average amplitude of the field in a box of size L. And we found this is how it goes, which is exactly the same expression that we now also found for the two-point correlator. So it seems that this result is pretty robust. It tells us how the size of quantum fluctuations scales, how quantum fluctuations scale as a function of time and as a function of scale of size, of physical size. And it's clear that the two calculations have to be connected, because on that order of physical size on which the quantum fluctuations are strongly correlated, we have that a smearing will do little, because we are calculating the average over something that's not varying much anyway. On the other hand, when we are at length scales larger than the correlation length, the length over which they are still significantly correlated, then we start averaging. If we do the averaging procedure, we average over uncorrelated things, and they average out to zero. So therefore, whether we measure the size of the quantum fluctuations as a function of the size of the box in which we average, or whether we measure the correlation length, or the size of the correlator as a function of the distance, these two things are very much correlated, because the correlator determines the averaging behavior in the box. And so what we found is that indeed we get just the same formula here. Since this formula is so robust, we give it a particular name. Call it the fluctuation spectrum of the quantum fluctuations, and that's what it is. So it's, I took the square root of this now, so it describes the standard deviation rather than the variance, or it describes the square root of the two-point correlator. But better perhaps to think of it as the standard deviation of the variance when averaging over a box. So we have here the standard deviation in the measurement of field amplitudes that are averaged over the size of a box. The size of a box of size L, where K and L are related by K equal to 2 pi over L, just to remind you of that. So this could be the standard deviation of averaging over a box, or it could be the two-point correlator. In any case, it scales like this, mode function of the phi field multiplied with K to the power 3/2. Let's see what we get if we apply that in the simplest case, just Minkowski space, Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space. In this case, the scale factor is always 1 for all times, and the mode functions we already calculated. This mode function gives us the correct vacuum for Minkowski space. It's the vacuum that is the state of lowest energy. It's also the adiabatic vacuum. In Minkowski space, everything is quite easy. This is the mode function. And it's the mode function for the field chi, but it's also the mode function for the field phi, because chi and phi don't differ in Minkowski space. They only differ by a scale factor, but the scale factor is always 1 in the case of Minkowski space. So this is the mode function, and the frequency that occurs in the mode function is given by k squared plus m squared, and there's no time dependence in this, just Minkowski space. And also, co-moving coordinates are the same as proper coordinates, and co-moving momenta are proper momenta in Minkowski space, no change. So then, what's the fluctuation spectrum? Here's the formula. Here's the expression for the standard deviation as a function of the mode function. And so we just plugged it in there, and we obtain this result. Standard deviation in the fluctuations of the averaged amplitude over a box is given by this expression, k to the third, 3/2 power, m squared plus k squared, the whole thing to the power of 1/4, because we inherit the k to the 3/2 from the general expression, a general formula for the quantum fluctuations, and then we have here a square root of omega k, omega being itself a square root. That's why we have a fourth root here. And then inside we have m squared plus k squared. That's over here. What's the asymptotic behavior? Well, if we let k go to infinity, then the mass doesn't matter here, right? Because this thing grows without bound. That grows without bound. And overall, we have that this goes, the denominator goes like k to the power of 1/2. The numerator goes like k to the power 3/2. So overall, the fluctuation spectrum goes proportionally to k. So for large k, which will correspond to small box sizes, because k is equal to 2 pi over L, for large k, small box sizes, whether or not we have a mass doesn't matter. And the size of the quantum fluctuations, the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations, in a box of size L, proportional to k, which means inverse proportional to L. So I'll give you the formula in L in a moment. Here it is. Here's everything expressed in terms of k because it's a little simpler. But over here, I'm expressing everything in terms of 2 pi over L, which is k. So the standard deviation in the measurement of the amplitude of a field when smeared over a box of size L is given by this expression here, where we have L to the power of minus 3/2. And here we have 1 over L squared, and here to the power 1/4. And for small l now, we see that the mass doesn't matter, because for small l, 1 over l squared will dominate completely the denominator. What when k goes to 0? So when we make the box very large. Well, when you make the box very large, then it seems that the mass matters, because as k goes small, as L goes large, k goes small, and therefore that term will eventually no longer matter. And we have only the mass term contributing here, so we have k to the power 3 half divided by m squared. This is the behavior for small k, or for large box sizes. If we're dealing with a field whose particles don't have a rest mass, well, then that term is absent, and we have a constellation here, which is exact, so we have the proportionality to k over all length scales, large or small. Don't even have to approximate then. Let us plot this as a curve. So here we have the size of the box, L, and here we have the standard deviation in the measurement of the average amplitude in the box of size L. And what we see is that for large k, which means for small l, we have proportionality to 1 over l. So we have a 1 over l behavior, 1 over l curve for small l. In particular, we see that this is divergent. This is the famous ultraviolet divergency. If we measure the amplitude averaged over a box of size L, then the expectation value is 0, but the standard deviation grows without bound as we make the box smaller and smaller. So the field fluctuates more and more widely. We only get a finite answer for the standard deviation if the box is of finite size. So the averaging in a finite size box gets rid of an infinite amount of fluctuation. If we make the box arbitrarily small, we see that infinite amount of fluctuation. Now, for large L, however, the behavior goes like k to the power of 3 half over square root of m, which means that the behavior is like 1 over L to the power 3 half, which means that the curve goes like that, 1 over L to the power 3 half. And it's not really visible very well that this behavior somehow changes from 1 over L to 1 over L to the power 3 half. Because overall, it's just diverging here and then asymptoting to 0 over there. So at large length scales, if we average a field over a large enough box, the standard deviation in the measurement of the field goes very small. So in particular, if we take a box of this size, like you get at the post office, and you measure the field amplitude averaged in that box, well, we are very far out there, very far on the right. And so the standard deviation in the average amplitude of the field when it is in the vacuum state is going to be very small. Even if you measure it for a very small box, it's still going to be very small. And yet you can measure those quantum fluctuations, for example, in the Casimir effect. Typically, the effect of quantum fluctuations becomes measurable on the scale of hundreds of nanometers or so. Then it becomes measurable. It becomes measurable earlier too, but not in macroscopic devices. But if you use a Casimir effect arrangement of just two parallel plates, or perhaps a plate and a sphere that are neutral, and they attract each other because of the radiation pressure from vacuum fluctuations, then that typically becomes measurable on the order of a distance between the two objects. They are macroscopic objects that you can see with your eyes when they are about hundreds of nanometers, perhaps a micron apart. But it's really an everyday occurrence. For example, in physical chemistry, you study that for a gas, pressure times volume equal to nkt, right? Something like this. And then you study corrections to that formula that come about because molecules take up volume and so on. But also, it turns out that there is, even among completely neutral molecules, there is some attractive force. That's the Casimir-Porter force. It's a generalization of the van der Waals force. And that affects chemistry. And the Casimir-Porter force is easily measurable, and it is an effect of quantum fluctuations. It's just not macroscopic for the individual occurrence of the force, because it's just between two molecules. But in a gas, it affects the gas equations of state. That's, in fact, how the Casimir effect was first observed. They saw a deviation from the van der Waals force and wondered, what's the origin? OK, when we looked at this plot, we noticed that we didn't notice how this behavior is different from that one. We know analytically it is different. This goes like L to the power minus 3 half. This goes like L to the power minus 1. How can we visualize that this behavior changes? It's, of course, at the onset of the importance of the mass term, right? But how do we visualize that? Well, let us remember log-log plots. Let's introduce two new variables. X is the logarithm of k. And y is the logarithm of delta phi k. So we basically take the logarithm of the two coordinates. When we do that, then the equation that the standard deviation in the phi k is given by this expression becomes that equation. We just took the logarithm of both sides. Taking the logarithm of the left side gives us the new variable x. Taking the logarithm on the right side allows us to simplify things a little bit. That's the whole point of using the logarithm, because it handles powers extremely well. So what we find is that for k going to infinity, for very small boxes in the ultraviolet, therefore, we have that it goes like logarithm of k, because it used to go proportional to k, but now we take the logarithm of it. And for k going to 0, we used to have the behavior k to the 3 half divided by square root of m, but now we take the logarithm of this. And in particular, this means that for k going to infinity, the behavior is like logarithm of k, but logarithm of k is x. So the y coordinate, this one, that one there, that one therefore, this thing, this thing goes like x for k going to infinity, which means for x going to infinity. Remember, the logarithm is monotonically increasing. So k going to infinity means x going to infinity. And we have that the logarithm of this thing plays out to be 3 half x minus 1 half logarithm of m, right? It's because this thing is to the power of minus 1 half. Get that in front. The logarithm of the quotient is the difference between the logarithms, and so on. So what we see here is that we get a curve y of x, which is simply y equal to x. So it goes at 45 degrees for x going to infinity. And it goes as y equal to some constant offset plus 3 half x. So here it's having a slope 1. Here, it's having a slightly steeper slope of 3 half with an offset. So let's plot this. So what we obtain here is that the size of the quantum fluctuations over the co-moving momentum, which is really 1 over the distance, behaves like that. Remember, this is the ultraviolet now. This is the small box case. Okay, small box this way. Large box that way, because we are plotting against k, or the logarithm of k, rather than L. So what we find is that for large momenta, small distances, we have this behavior of y equal x, 45 degree slope. Then at about the logarithm of the mass, this thing becomes a steeper slope of 3 half, until it hits this constant offset over there. What would have happened if there were no mass, if the particle was massless? Well, then this slope 1 curve would have simply continued and hit it over here. So what we see is that in Minkowski space, and all of this was still Minkowski space, for small k, which means large boxes, for large boxes, the quantum fluctuations are suppressed. You see, this is measuring the size of the quantum fluctuations, are suppressed. If we go, if there was no mass term, quantum fluctuations would be suppressed this way. And since if there is a mass term, they are even suppressed further down on this logarithmic scale. So the more mass a particle species has, the more are the quantum fluctuations suppressed for large distances. Maybe you can imagine it this way. A quantum fluctuation of a particle that has a mass sort of costs energy, because you have to create them with at least their rest mass, just intuitively. And if you have, if you're considering wavelengths that are large, like for a large box, large wavelengths, those large wavelengths don't have much energy. The longer the wavelength, the smaller is the frequency, the smaller is h bar omega, the smaller is the energy available. But it's just an intuition. Okay, so regarding the infrared, regarding large boxes, what we found is that the mass does matter. It does not matter at the very short distances. In the ultraviolet, it doesn't matter. The behavior was insensitive to the mass. But at large distances, the mass does matter. And what the mass does is to suppress the quantum fluctuations. Not completely, but it makes the quantum fluctuations go down somewhat faster than without a mass. Without mass, 1 over L behavior of the variance. With mass, 1 over 3 half. L to the power three minus 3 half. Also, notice that clearly, from the way we calculated this, all of these things are dimension dependent. If you calculated the same things that we just calculated in 4, 5, or 6 space dimensions, you would get certainly a different behavior. The whole curve would look very different. If you calculated it in lower dimensions, very different. And I leave it to you as an exercise to find out in which way they're different. Well, I give you a hint. There are way more quantum fluctuations the higher the dimensions are. But figure it out yourself. Just try. Basically, whenever we have polar coordinates, you get an extra power there if you go up with the dimension, right? And then just find out what that does. Okay, so this is just to reiterate that in quantum field theory, the most interesting part is always the short distance part. It's the high energy collisions that probe the short distances. And at short distances, we have this divergent behavior of the quantum fluctuations. And we found that for that purpose, the mass plays no role. Quantum fluctuations are not impacted by the presence or absence of mass terms in the action. This is something that you may have heard of already in a course on quantum field theory for particle physics, if you have taken such a course. Then you would have arrived at a similar conclusion with completely different methods. There, you check what quantum field theory does at very small distances for the purpose of renormalization. And there you find that the treatment of the ultraviolet divergences is insensitive to the existence of a mass term. And here we see why that is. There, you usually just see it analytically in the behavior of integrals. But now we see that it's, well, we also saw it through integrals, but we saw what it means. It means that the mass term suppresses quantum fluctuations for large boxes, but for small boxes, it doesn't impact quantum fluctuations at all. And it's the quantum fluctuations that are responsible for ultraviolet divergences. Another comment I wanted to make here is that we are predicting here that the quantum fluctuations of a field that we average over a box become divergingly strong as we make the box smaller and smaller. Something cannot be quite right about this. Not only does this behavior mess up the perturbative calculations of the scattering of particles, the so-called famous ultraviolet divergences, but also it is a very profound worry for gravitational theories. Let us think it to the end. What we just calculated is that in Minkowski space, if you take a box of smaller and smaller size, the average amplitude of the fluctuations, standard deviation of the fluctuations of the field in there, is divergingly large. And we would get the same for the derivative of the field as well. But the field and its derivatives enter into the energy-momentum tensor. And the energy-momentum tensor, through the Einstein equation, is curving space. So we predicted here that the field and its derivatives are wildly fluctuating, even divergingly so, as we look at the average over a smaller and smaller box. Which means that if we take a very small box, the energy-momentum tensor ought to be fluctuating very wildly. Not if you average it out, but if you look at it at a small box, the energy-momentum tensor in there will fluctuate very wildly. So the Einstein equation, that should mean that the curvature fluctuates very, very wildly. So it has been suggested that this means that space-time really becomes a foam or something that we have no classical description for. In any case, the notion of distance is thought to break down. The idea is that if you want, let's just spell it out completely again. If you want to measure there's a first quantization argument that goes along with the second quantization argument. Let me give you the first quantization argument because it might be easier to remember. We just did it in a more sophisticated way here. Imagine you have a particle, or you use particles to resolve small distances. Then you have what your goal is to make delta x of the particle very small. So you want to use that particle as the tip of as a tip of a probe, or you want to use it as the light of a microscope. You want to resolve small distances. So you need to know where that particle is. So you need to make delta x very small. But by the uncertainty principle, that means that the momentum of the particle has to be very large, eventually. If you make delta x smaller and smaller, the particle's momentum must become uncertain, more and more uncertain. But momentum, just like energy, is curving space. So therefore, by making delta x of the particle very small, we're making delta p of the particle very large. So if the momentum is fluctuating a lot, and momentum curves space, it means that space must be, the curvature of space must be fluctuating a lot. But this means that our efforts to resolve small distances has been defeated. We set out to measure very small distances. That's why we try to make delta x very small. But the end result was that space-time is fluctuating very wildly. Curvature tensor is fluctuating very wildly. But if it is fluctuating very wildly, we cannot tell what the distance between two points is. We need to know what the curvature is to be able to tell what the distance is between two points. So therefore, from this first quantization argument, we see that there is probably no way to measure distances smaller than a certain length scale, namely where this snake bites itself in the tail, right? Where we try to make delta x very, very small, but we end up creating so much curvature uncertainty that for sure we cannot make delta x any smaller. If you just think about the scales that are involved, you can estimate at what scale that happens, and that is the Planck scale. So at the Planck, above the Planck scale, you can still think of a delta x small enough to get a really good resolution of what you want to see. But if you want to make delta x even smaller than the Planck length, well, then you have curvature fluctuations of a scale that are larger than that. And therefore, you really are fooling yourself when you think that you have a delta x smaller than the Planck length. And here we saw this in second quantization. Instead of thinking of a particle and its position and its momentum and position uncertainty and momentum uncertainty, here we are thinking of the field that gives birth to the particles. Right? So like the electron field or Klein-Gordon field and so on. And what we see is that if we want to localize a field, then there are fluctuations in the energy momentum tensor, which ultimately ought to curve space. And that, of course, prevents us from even defining what we mean by a box of such a small size, because the curvature will be uncertain, so we can't say what the size of the box is ultimately. So now, let's see what happens when we study that in an expanding space-time. So far, this was just an argument for Minkowski space. Curvature got in because we went to the extreme, and we said, OK, what if we make the box very small? And then we found, well, that it creates fluctuations in energy momentum, which should curve space. But apart from that, we started out with flat Minkowski space. Now, let us look at the time evolution of a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space-time and see what it does to the fluctuation spectrum. Remember, so far, we assume that the system is in that state zero, which comes along with a particular choice of mode function with an A and a Dagger operator. Sorry, that is a bad typo here. Okay. So we're assuming here that we know that the system is in this state that came along with these mode functions and with these creation and annihilation operators. And presumably, this was the vacuum state early on. We will get into the discussion of this later on. And then we found that this is the fluctuation spectrum, fluctuation power spectrum, as a function of the size of the box that we are considering. You know, the k is 2 pi over L, and as a function of time as well. We can do that because the system is always going to be in that state. If it is in that state at the beginning, it's always going to be in that state because we work with the Heisenberg picture. All of the time evolution is in the operators. And well, we calculated what the fluctuations are in the operator phi, which we time evolved properly. So this is giving us the size of the, this is giving us the fluctuation spectrum as a function not only of the scale, of the size of the box, but also as a function of time. Now, one might expect that perhaps the fluctuation spectrum is simply not affected by the whole business of space-time expanding. Certainly, if space-time is expanding very slowly, we would expect this to be the case. Let's say space-time is expanding very slowly. At an early age in the universe, we do some measurements of quantum fluctuations, and we find this 1 over L and then 1 over L to the power 3 half behavior. Fine. And then we wait a few billion years, and then we measure again, and we find the same behavior. That's what we would expect. What, however, if space-time in those intervening billions of years actually had a turbulent history? What if it went adiabatic? What if it went non-adiabatic? Could have produced particles that should show up in the correlator. It should show up in those fluctuations. Or even more dramatic, it could be that the evolution was so wild that, at least temporarily, the harmonic oscillator of the mode of the mode in question and study here might have gone inverted, right? In which case, we don't even have a particle picture. Then how does that affect what the fluctuation spectrum is going to be later on? the great thing about using the Heisenberg picture and having solved the whole problem completely so far is that even if the universe underwent a turbulent history, non-adiabatic, all sorts of dramatic stuff happening, that formula is still correct. The only challenge is to actually calculate what that mode function is as a function of time. In fact, if the universe started out as Minkowski space, in the simplest case, that might be an assumption. If it started out early on something like Minkowski space, or actually Minkowski space, then we know what the mode function was early on. In particular, we know the amplitude and its derivative at a particular point in time. And then we just have to take the Klein-Gordon equation for the given expansion rate of the universe, for the given scale factor function, and solve it. Second order ODE. If need be, we do it numerically. So we start out with a known Minkowski space wave function, mode function, and then just numerically integrate, if that's necessary, to find the mode function later on. And that will tell us what the fluctuation spectrum is going to be. Exactly. I mean, as precisely as we can get the evolution of the mode function. One thing we can read off from this formulation right away is that we should look out for the overall behavior of the mode function, the modulus of it. If the modulus goes small, we should expect that that impacts the quantum fluctuation, makes them small. If the modulus goes big, quantum fluctuations are expected to turn out big. Where this is really the mode function of the field chi. The mode function of the field phi, the physical field, is of course this divided by the scale factor. And the scale factor, of course, increases dramatically. Right? So in order for the, for example, in order for the quantum fluctuations to stay of the same size over time for a fixed k, in order for that to happen, we would have to have that the mode function grows at the same rate as the scale factor goes, grows as well. For example, for the Sitter space, the Sitter universe, we have exponential increase in the scale factor. So this is an exponential suppression because the scale factor is in the denominator. Therefore, for the quantum fluctuations to just stay the same size, we would actually have to have that the mode function blows up exponentially in amplitude. Could such a thing ever happen? It could, because the harmonic oscillator of the mode might go inverted. And then you have a situation that's mathematically like a particle or a ball sitting on top of a hill and then rolling down that hill. A hill that's very steep and gets steeper as you go because it's an inverted parabola. It's steeper as you go. There's a chance that it actually makes that mode function, which is a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation after all, grow its modulus exponentially, making up for that exponential suppression here, which will make the quantum fluctuations stay of the same size. This is actually what's going to happen. But why is that dramatic? Doesn't that just mean, well, it's the same thing as before? Doesn't that just mean that, well, quantum fluctuations stay of the same size? So nothing special? No, it means something very special. Because remember that it would mean that the quantum fluctuations stay the same size for a fixed k, right? The k mode. But that doesn't mean a fixed physical wavelength. That's a growing physical wavelength. So the universe is expanding. Our waves are expanding because we have a coordinate system that grows with the expansion. So we are really looking at a box that's growing. In fact, in the case of the Sitter space, where it's exponential growth, we have that the box is growing exponentially quickly in its size. And what we are saying here is that if that cancellation happens, the quantum fluctuations amplitude, the standard deviation of the fluctuations, stays the same even as the box grows. So normally, in Minkowski space, we would expect that a small box has a large amplitude of fluctuations. A large box has a small amplitude of fluctuations. But what we will find is that in cosmology, you can start out with a small box. You look at the small box, and it has, yes, large fluctuations. But then, as the universe expands very, very rapidly, this box grows exponentially quickly. A fraction of a second later, it is billions of light years across. And the amplitude of the fluctuations, the standard deviation of the fluctuations in that box, stays the same. It's still as large as it was when the box was very small. And in this way, we have an effective amplification of the quantum fluctuations in a box. It's just that the quantum fluctuations of a small box get basically ripped to very large scale. Well, I'm anticipating all this stuff, we should actually calculate it, right? So, okay. So at this point, I really only wanted to say that if this goes large, quantum fluctuations go large, but it's suppressed by that. Okay. So what is the most efficient mechanism to enlarge the mode function? Remember that if the universe is expanding dramatically, like at the beginning, at Big Bang, then this is a very strong suppression. Could it happen that this is a very that there's a very strong amplification going on in this? Remember that if those two guys cancel their behavior, it just means that the mode function of the field phi itself is sort of behaving normally, not extremely, staying the same modulus. Okay, so in which what can happen to the mode? Damn it. This thing goes into tablet mode now. Sorry. I can undo this, but I don't know how that happened. See, it's normally a regular PC, but it can go into this toy mode. So, yeah, it's all graphical and, you know, for playing, I guess. Okay, so, the point I want to make is that there is a chance that the amplitude of the harmonic oscillator, the amplitude of that mode function, grows very quickly, namely when the harmonic oscillator equation, the mode equation, inverts its potential. So the most efficient mechanism to enlarge the mode functions, modulus, is when its frequency, when the frequency of the harmonic oscillator goes imaginary. Because then the frequency squared goes negative, and what used to be this potential becomes that potential. Remember that the frequency of that occurs in the Klein-Gordon equation on an expanding spacetime has this extra term in it, a double prime over a. It cares not about the velocity of the acceleration, not about the velocity of the expansion, but the acceleration of the expansion. Okay, so when the acceleration of the expansion is very large, then this goes negative, and we have this effect. By the way, it has been pointed out that this does not necessarily require the universe to expand very dramatically. Of course, if it does expand very dramatically with a positive acceleration, you get this effect. But you could also have that the universe decelerates dramatically. It could be that it's shrinking and that you get a large acceleration in this way. And this leads to so-called bounds scenarios in cosmology. Okay, so when that term dominates over these terms, then the omega goes goes imaginary, and the potential, the effective potential that you get for the harmonic oscillator, changes sign, and instead of having the usual x squared potential, now you have the minus x squared potential. Notice that whether or not this term dominates depends on the value of k. You can always find k is large enough so that they dominate in this square root here. So what we find here is that some modes may have regular behavior with how much being basically in a harmonic oscillator like this, while others will be in a harmonic oscillator like that. And we will find out where the threshold is. We will find out that long wavelength modes can be in that inverted case, short wavelength modes, short enough wavelength modes will be still oscillating as usual. And the threshold between them is the size of the horizon that comes about due to the expansion. Yes?
So when this rapid expansion, does the ultraviolet limit, cutoff limit change? Because
in practical calculations, we usually put an ultraviolet cutoff, especially in particle physics. It's usually put in there as a regulator and then eventually removed. Take the limit for that removes the ultraviolet cutoff. So it's just a technical tool. However, many also consider the case where the ultraviolet cutoff is taken at the Planck length with the argument that probably there is no sense to a distance smaller than that. And then it's a physical ultraviolet cutoff. And the difficulty then is to implement it in a covariant fashion. We do not want to break local Lorentz invariance. We do not want to have the whole edifice of general relativity fall apart. Most authors nevertheless do it in a non-covariant way. So they single out a coordinate system. They don't go as far as have the ultraviolet cutoff purposely change over time. It's meant to be the Planck length at early times in the universe, meant to be the physical Planck length at late times in the universe. It's not the co-moving distance, but the proper distance that's cut off. But really, that's not consistent, because you can always go into a coordinate system in which 5 meters look like a Planck length. If you don't do it covariantly, then really it's not consistent.
Sorry, did you say that deceleration can cause an inversion as well?
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't the sign of the acceleration in that formula determine whether or not the thing becomes imaginary?
Yeah, but think of it this way. Imagine that the universe is already shrinking a lot, right? So you have an A prime that's negative, very negative, and you want to make it more positive. So your A double prime has the same sign, right, as in the case of the acceleration. Okay, so I was just saying that the threshold will be, as we will find out, the horizon size. The expansion comes with a horizon. You know, anything that's further away than that horizon can no longer communicate. And it turns out that waves whose wavelength is larger than that will have the inverted harmonic oscillators, and those that have wavelengths smaller than that will have the regular harmonic oscillators. Okay. And of course, waves change their status over time because they get stretched out. So a wave that used to be small enough wavelength that it is smaller than the horizon size, over time will grow in wavelength until it eventually hits the horizon size and beyond, and then its harmonic oscillator will be this one. Eventually, inflation comes to a halt. I mean, the exponential expansion, or nearly exponential expansion, comes to a halt. Then the horizon grows very large, and all those modes go back to having the ordinary behavior then, because the A double prime becomes so small then. Okay. So quantum mechanically, this is what happens. When the harmonic oscillator has the usual type of potential, then you will have a ground state, which is something like a Gaussian, and it just stays like that. If the harmonic oscillator wiggles a little bit because of some non-adiabatic behavior, let's say the universe accelerates, breaks, accelerates, breaks, accelerates, then it would do this. And that behavior can be non-adiabatic if it's fast enough, if it's faster than the natural oscillation frequency of the oscillator, and that can create particles. That's a possibility. But a much more efficient way to really do something with this ground state wave function and change it away from the ground state wave function is to have the potential at least temporarily flip sign. And when that happens to a mode, then what used to be, let's say, the ground state, which is like a Gaussian here, that Gaussian flows apart very quickly. Right? A particle would roll down left or right, but here we're dealing with wave functions. We are dealing with probability distributions over field amplitudes. And if they are initially Gaussian distributed, they will flow apart very quickly. And eventually, the harmonic oscillator will flip up again when the initial explosive period comes to an end. And then the harmonic oscillator catches that again. But by then, the wave function will have stretched out a lot. Keep in mind, though, that this is the picture for the chi field and its Fourier coefficients. So for the chi field, we have these runaway solutions because the harmonic oscillator potential is inverted. The chi field's mode function, V, will have a modulus, therefore, that can grow very, very quickly. But remember, that's offset by having the scale factor in the denominator. Right? The universe expands very quickly. The scale factor A of eta grows very quickly. That's in the denominator of the fluctuation formula. And the two things just offset each other. And the mathematics of this is that the chi field is a field which has inverted harmonic oscillator occurring, but no friction term. Remember why we did the chi field, why we considered the chi field at all. It's because the phi field, the original physical field phi, was a harmonic oscillator with a friction term that we didn't have experience with. So we changed variables and so on. If we go back to the physical thing, what we find is that the friction term will dominate and will basically freeze the field, will freeze its amplitude. That's the mathematical twin, or that's the expression of what we see in the chi field, that the chi field explodes exponentially, the scale factor explodes exponentially, and the two just cancel each other. The ratio of the two cancel each other, and the phi field simply freezes its evolution. which is the mathematical expression of the fact that the quantum fluctuations freeze their size. Even though the box is growing, the standard deviations of the fluctuations in the box stays the same. OK, now before we actually calculate the fluctuation amplification explicitly, that will be done in the next lecture, let us look back at the particle creation and see how particle creation through expansion relates to fluctuation amplification. So today we've worked in the wave picture. Let us look back at the particle picture of the same phenomena. So let's assume that at some late time eta 1, the evolution of the universe is adiabatic again. So it might have gone through a rough stretch of some wild adventures, and it had all sorts of non-adiabatic behavior. But let's say that at some later time, eta 1, the universe was in smoother waters, and it just evolved adiabatically again. In this case, we can identify the vacuum at a later time, namely as the adiabatic vacuum. So we identify the adiabatic vacuum using the usual adiabatic vacuum identification criterion that gives us the amplitude and the derivative of the mode function at the time eta 1 when we want to determine the adiabatic vacuum. Having the mode function's amplitude and derivative at a particular time, like eta 1, allows us to calculate that mode function at all time, of course, using the Klein-Gordon equation. Anyway, the situation is that at time eta 1, the universe evolves adiabatically. We can use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion to find out the correct mode function v tilde, which then comes along with a tilde and a dagger tilde operators, and with a vector 0 tilde, and with creation annihilation operator, with the states that you get by applying the creation operators on that. I should probably put a tilde over there. But that's the state in the Hilbert space that describes the vacuum at the time eta 1. And we also have, of course, the state 0 without a tilde, which is the state that the universe really is in. And that's the vector in the Hilbert space that used to be the vacuum vector early on. Now let's assume case 1, simplest case, that the universe was evolving adiabatically from very early days up until the time eta 1 now, up until this later time eta 1 anyway. So if the universe was evolving adiabatically all the time, then the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion picks the same vacuum state in early times as in late times, and the same mode function at early times as in late times. That's how the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion was designed. So we obtain that the vector in the Hilbert space that describes the vacuum at the late time happens to be the same vector that describes the vacuum at an early time. And if we assume that the universe started out in this state, it always stays in that state. And at the later time, it's still the vacuum state, so no particles were created. You might think that that means everything is trivial in this case, but that's not quite so. Because remember what the mode function looks like when the universe expands adiabatically. The mode function will look like this. Right? That's the adiabatic solution. The universe expands or evolves adiabatically all the time from eta naught to eta 1. That's the mode function. It obeys the vacuum identification criterion at all times. But this mode function is not the same. It doesn't have to have the same value early as it has late. Right? If we evaluate its modulus at time eta 1, it doesn't have to be the same as its modulus at time eta 0. But it was the modulus that determined the size of the quantum fluctuations. So in principle, we can have some non-trivial behavior of the quantum fluctuations, even though no particles were created. Now let's look at case 2. That's a situation where the universe was not always adiabatic between times eta 0 and eta 1. In this case, the vacuum identification criterion applied at time eta 0 gives us one mode function, and the vacuum identification criterion applied at time eta 1 gives us another mode function. And those two guys are not the same. Now, we do know that both live in the same solution space of the Klein-Gordon equation, which has only two complex dimensions. So we know that there must exist coefficients alpha and beta for each mode. There is always a subscript k here. There must exist coefficients alpha and beta so that we can write the mode function that comes with one adiabatic vacuum, namely at early times, is a linear combination of the mode function and its complex conjugate, the mode function that comes with the vacuum identification at a later time. So we can express those mode functions in terms of each other. Now let's look at our basic equation, namely the equation that tells us what the size of the quantum fluctuations is, the standard deviation of amplitudes in a box. It was this expression, and it expressed here in terms of the mode function of the vacuum at early times, the state in which the universe really is in. So that's the V that comes with the vacuum identification criterion at early times. And now this V can be expressed in terms of the V tildes. Let's do that. So we just substitute this stuff in here for the VK. Then we obtain that. So now we have the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations expressed in terms of a to the power minus 2, k to the third power, and then those alphas and betas and the V stars and V star tildes. for simplicity now, let's assume that the non-adiabatic period is over by eta 1. So the universe underwent some non-adiabatic period, but let's just say it has calmed down after time eta 1. And so now it's adiabatic. In fact, let's assume that it's Minkowski space, just to get to a clear outcome of the calculation. In this case, we do know what the mode function at late times looks like, because we know what the mode function is for Minkowski space. We know what the vacuum identification criterion will yield when the universe is behaving like Minkowski space. Namely, that's the mode function for Minkowski space. So applying the vacuum identification criterion at late times, when the non-adiabatic period is over and the universe is actually adiabatic and actually in Minkowski space, then we obtain this for the mode function. Let's plug that in. Remember, we had this expression for the standard deviation of the or the variance of the quantum fluctuations. Now we plug in the Minkowski space solution over here. And then we obtain that. We obtain that the variance of the field fluctuations in a box is given by these well-known prefactors now. And then we have here the alpha coefficient modulus squared plus the beta coefficient modulus squared minus 2 times the real part of this business here. Now, remember those alpha and beta coefficients, they occur in the linear combination of one mode function in terms of the basis of the other mode function. What is this business here? This is oscillatory. E to the power of 2i omega k times eta. Now, how fast is this oscillating? Very fast, because we are dealing with a quantum field. Omega is its natural oscillation frequency. Think of ordinary light, very fast oscillations. So let's say we are interested in measuring quantum fluctuations of fields in a box or so. If our measurement process takes a little longer than that period, which is easy to do in practical measurements, especially if it's to do with cosmology, then we don't actually see that term because it will completely average out. And this will dominate. So what we find is that for sufficiently slow measurements, but that is not very slow, can still be very fast, we have that the variance of the quantum fluctuations in a box of size L, where k is equal to 2 pi over L, is given by this expression here. We made use of the fact that the alpha and the beta coefficients are not completely independent of each other. Remember why that was. In principle, any linear combination of two solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation are a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. So in principle, we can choose the alpha and the beta arbitrarily. But we also want that the linear combination obeys the Wronskian condition. And that imposes this, right? It has to obey the new linear combination also has to obey that condition that ensures that the AA dagger commutation relations translate into the phi pi commutation relations. Okay, so that allows us to express to eliminate the alpha and express everything in terms of beta. So what we see now is that the quantum fluctuations, the variance of the quantum fluctuations is given by an expression that involves the beta here. And the beta is measuring the non-adiabaticity, if you remember from earlier. Beta quantifies the amount of particle creation. We calculated the expectation value of the number operator as we excited the universe from the vacuum to a non-vacuum state. And the outcome was proportional to the modulus of beta squared. So here is the formula. We found that the number of the expected number of particles created in the mode k out of the vacuum due to non-adiabatic evolution, this formula here, we calculated, I just put the three dots, it's a few pages in a previous lecture, is given by the modulus squared of beta k. So there we have it. We have a relationship between the particle creation here and the quantum fluctuations over there, the standard deviation of the quantum fluctuations, with a little bit of decoration in here as well. The whole thing depends on the size and so on. However, so you might think, well, isn't it then just a reformulation? And couldn't we just talk about the particle picture all the time? We couldn't, because our formula, for example, this one, makes sense no matter whether the harmonic oscillator is simply non-adiabatic because it is shaking, or whether the harmonic oscillator even inverts. Still true, that formula, with the beta here. However, that makes no sense when the harmonic oscillator is inverted, because then there's no number operator. When the harmonic oscillator is inverted, then we don't have a discrete spectrum where a creation operator could get us one step up each time we apply it, and an annihilation operator could get us one step down. No, the spectrum is continuous. Right, so there's no way that we could do this particle picture for the inverted harmonic oscillators. So the field picture, the wave picture, so to speak, is more robust. It applies always, whereas the particle picture is not that robust. So that's the remark here, that our equation up here holds even when omega squared is negative, when the frequencies are imaginary. So in that sense, quantum fields are more fundamental than quantum particles. Also, we can look briefly at fluctuations in proper coordinates as opposed to co-moving coordinates. If L is the co-moving length, then the proper length, for example, of our box, is given by the scale factor times the co-moving length, right? Because everything is expanding along with the universe. And for the momentum, it's just the inverse because of the Fourier transform, of the nature of Fourier transform. So if k is the co-moving momentum, the Fourier transform of the L's, of the x's, then the proper momentum is given by 1 over a times k. Therefore, if we write down the size of the quantum fluctuations amplitudes, the standard of the variance of the quantum fluctuations amplitudes in a box of size L, then this is the formula for it, where we've just put the scale factor in the right places now. This is the formula that we had above. If we now plug in the scaling, then we obtain that expression down here. So we find that the quantum fluctuations variance is given by this prefactor here, where these are physical momenta, which we can translate into physical length scales for a box, for example. And here you see this beta coefficient, which can be interpreted as being proportional to particle production when we can speak of particle production. But there may not be particle production. There may not be a sense in which particles have been created because the harmonic oscillator is inverted, and then that still applies. Notice also that that term here is dependent on the on the proper momentum, on the physical length scale, but also multiplied with the scale factor of the universe. So we calculated it here for the case that the universe underwent, the formula that we had here above, this one is calculated for the case where the universe starts out in the known vacuum state, then undergoes potentially a very, very non-adiabatic period, but eventually settles to actually Minkowski space again, right? And then that was the outcome. It would be a little bit more subtle if we wanted to calculate the outcome when the universe doesn't settle into Minkowski space, but is adiabatic, but not Minkowski space. Remember, we only use Minkowski space here because for Minkowski space, we can easily write down what the mode function is. but it's not much harder to do it for the adiabatic case as well. It's just that then it depends on exactly how it is moving. How is it adiabatic? There are different amplitudes and velocities that you could choose there. All right. Okay, so what we will do in the next steps is then to calculate exactly how the quantum fluctuations behave under the expansion and how the amplitudes of the quantum fluctuations depend crucially on whether the wave in question, the mode in question, has a wavelength that is smaller or larger than the horizon size during the expansion. Okay, that's it for today.